I'm going to start with another little story, and I want to thank my coworkers for coming to support me today. And some of these stories they have heard, but I am glad that they are here. I'm going to tell you a story of when this is about driving again. I'm not sure how the stories have to do with driving. When I was 16, my mother had come into some money that she had inherited, and she decided that we should get a second car so that I could help her with transporting my younger siblings to school. So we went to this car lot to look at a car. She had a limited amount of money, so we needed to find something in that budget, something that she felt would be safe. So we go to this car lot. She's explaining it to the car salesman, and he goes, "Oh, I know just the car for you." So he brings out this little four-door Datsun. Anybody remember the old Datsun cars? Okay, little four-door Datsun, and he brings it around, and it was so cute, and it's like, oh, yeah, I'm so excited, 16, a car. And we open it up, and it's a stick shift. And the guy says, "She does know how to drive a stick shift, doesn't she?" And my mom goes, "Well, I don't know." And looks at me, "You do know how to drive a stick shift, don't you?" And I went, "Yeah, uh-huh, sure." Never driven a stick shift before. But I had driven a three-speed on the column, so I'm thinking, how much different can it be? You just get in there. So I get in that car. We test drive after a few little, I get it worked out, and off we go. And the car's great, good price. We buy it, and we take it home. We haven't had it very long, several months. And I drive back and forth to Academy. Again, mother says, "This car is for you to drive back and forth to school only and errands as I tell you to drive them. Nothing else." So I'm at school one day, and my neighbor friend says, "Let's go home for lunch." And I go, "You know, I'm not supposed to be driving the car back and forth except to school and from school." And she goes, "It'll be okay. Nobody ever know. We'll go home. We'll eat. We'll come back. Won't be any big deal. It'll be all right." And I'm going, I don't know. You know, I've had enough of this from mom to know I better think about this. So, she kept at it. So finally I went, okay. So we go home to her house and we eat lunch and we're hurrying back, get back in the car to hurry back to school. And it's a beautiful spring day. The weather is gorgeous, and I probably had a touch of spring fever. And we're driving along this kind of curvy road, and we're probably chatting, and probably have the radio cranked up full blast. I don't know. But we're driving along, and for whatever reason, Sherry took her eyes off of the road for a moment and ended up going over a, I don't remember how many feet, cliff embankment and literally rolled the car. It landed upright like it was supposed to, but it did a complete turn. And I am like this, and I realize my friend is not in the seat next to me. And my first thought is, I've killed my friend. I've killed my friend, because the windows were down. And I'm thinking, she got thrown out of the car. I've killed my friend. And then I hear her going, "What in the world happened?" And she's in the back seat. So I was very grateful for that. But we're like, are we okay? Are we okay? And we get out of the car. We're okay. And somebody had seen it happen. And so they drove up, and then another car drove up. They sent a car to call the police. So the policeman comes, and they're all like, "Wow, we can't believe you girls aren't hurt, flipping over that embankment." Well, when everything was all taken care of, the policeman got to escort me home in his police car. So we go driving up the driveway, and the policeman gets out, opens the door for me to get out, and he walks me up to the door. And, of course, my mother meets us at the door with her eyes like this. The police officer explains what happened, and then he left, and I'm sitting here like, oh, I'm going to get it now. And mother just looked at me and said, "Are you all right?" And I went, "Yeah." And then she just grabbed me and hugged me. That was the best punishment she could have ever given me, because I did not wreck a car again for 30 years. So, but the point was, I had this still small voice trying to tell me this was not a good idea, and I didn't listen. So that's kind of what I'm going to talk about today a little bit. I've got a slide up here, as you can see, what a story, my life in a nutshell, but it's going to be my conversion in a whole. And then the next slide is the verse. I'd like for you to read it in the clear word version. This has become my favorite verse lately, and I love this version. I already know the plans I have for you. I will help you, not hurt you. I will give you a future and a hope. You will call on me, and I will answer. You will talk to me, and I will listen. You will seek me and find me as you search for me with all your heart. It tells me that God has something special for me, and that's my story. And we all have a story, different types of stories, but we all have a story. An online dictionary definition of story is an account or recital of an event or a series of events, either true or fictitious, which leads us to the next slide. The story you are about to hear is true. None of the characters' names have been changed. Some of the details may be sketchy due to time and memory. The story will be dramatized for effect. Some of the story may be graphic in description, so the wording will be modified for children. And some of the story will be sad and tissue may be needed. So you have been warned there. The next slide is, can you guess which one is me? The little blondie is me, is a little girl. I'm with an aunt and some uncles. And my story typically would start at the very beginning of my life. But we're going to kind of skip the very beginning because I'm learning as you're up front, your time limit gets shortened like this by the time you actually get up here. So we're going to stop with that picture there. And I'm actually going to pick up my story this morning with the following statement. Miss Betty Ford made this statement after the death of her mother. I believe there's a meaning for everyone's coming into this world, that we're put here for a purpose. Now, when we're children, we don't understand that. As my mother said, she became Adventist in her 20s. I was a young child, about 11 years old at that time, and that was very new to me, becoming an Adventist, you know, going from the secular world into this church that was very different, very foreign. We became members of the Forest Lake Seventh-day Adventist Church, which is also a very affluent church, and we came from kind of the less affluent side of the tracks, so that was a little intimidating to me as a child. But we became Adventist. I remember learning more about the Bible than I ever had, and as a child, I was glad of that. I was baptized into the Adventist church. I had actually been baptized in the Baptist church, which is very scary. So the second baptism was not as scary. I knew what was coming, so I was glad of that. Which, by the way, I'm going to digress a little bit, which my people at work know I do this a lot. It's just my female brain. My first recollection of church, I have to tell you this, my first recollection of church, when my mother realized she needed to get us kids back into church, it was the Baptist church, and I was 8 years old. And this is my first memory of going to church. We were sitting in church, and she had three of us kids, probably the baby, on her lap. She always kept an arm like this because, you know, mothers are good at doing this when they need to get your attention. And we were sitting there, and you know, she's make sure she has our attention, that we're sitting upright and paying attention. And there were these deacons on the front row, and one of the deacons went, and I told my mom, look, he fell asleep in church. And all of a sudden, all these men rushed up to the front of the church. He had not fallen asleep, he had had a heart attack, and they had to rush him out of the church. He was fine. He did survive. But that's my first recollection of church, so just had to throw that in there. So we become Adventist, and we spent 1 year at Forest Lake, and it was okay, new and different. You know, the adjustments that a young girl is having to make at teenage years of all of a sudden what you think you're going to do that you are not allowed to do. So there was a little adjusting there. Then we moved around a little bit different. We went to Kentucky. We lived there for a couple of years. Mom would go where she could try to find better jobs. And then we moved to North Carolina. We lived there for a little while. She helped run a little in-home nursing home. That was quite of an experience. And then we moved to Tennessee. Madison, Tennessee, which is where I went to academy, and that's where I had my car wreck. And that's where life really started taking a turn for me. I had always been a fairly good child, wouldn't you say, Mother? I was probably pretty good, pretty obedient child. I felt that I had done good, tried to do good, but I was floundering with direction in my life. And my mother decided to remarry when I was 16. And there, she had four children, and he had three children, and we were all merged together in one house. So that was a little bit of an adjustment there, too. And at that particular time in my life, it just wasn't working out for me. And so being a young girl, I made a foolish decision involving love and ended up expecting a child at age 17 and then was married shortly after that. That's not the way that I recommend anybody start, but when it happens, you learn to make the best with it and you go from there. My husband grew up in an Adventist home, but he was not an Adventist church goer, and he didn't particularly care for me going to church. He was very jealous, and he thought that it was better for him to keep an eye on me at home. So the marriage was a little bit rocky. We had the first child, then we had another child. And after about 4.5 years, I finally realized that this just isn't going to work. So I told him that. I said, I think that we need to just go our separate ways. He didn't like that idea, but I knew it was going to be the best thing for me. So we went our separate ways. So here I am at 21 years old with two small children. No husband, no college education, and figuring out how I'm going to make a living to support myself and my kids. So obviously you cut corners wherever you can. And what I had to do for my two children was have a babysitter watch them because I could not afford to put them in a daycare. So my youngest son, and I think I have a picture here of the two babies, actually. Yeah, there's my first two beautiful babies. The bigger one's Lynette, my daughter, and she's holding my son, Shannon. So there's my two babies. And then the next one, if we go to the next slide, this is my son, Shannon, my oldest son, and he's about 2 years old there. And you can see he's a healthy and happy little boy. He's had a grand time eating something, so it's all over the front of him, and his pants are twisted and crooked, but happy little boy. But at the babysitters that I took them to, he got to where when I would pick them up, he would just cry. And when I would take him in the morning and drop him off, he would just cry and hang on to my legs. And I know a lot of kids do that. And it breaks your heart as a mother to have to leave them, but you have to leave them to go to work. Well, one day, and again, it's interesting to me how something can happen in your life that you never really forget the incident, but I can't remember the date. I can remember it was a January of 1979, and I worked at a bank as a bank teller, and it was snowing, horribly snowing. So I went home from work on Thursday, made my way through the snow to pick up the kids, the babysitters, and she says, Shannon, the little one, isn't really feeling well, and so I laid him down. Why don't you just let him stay here overnight? Because you're just going to bring him back in the morning anyway. And I'm like, no, I really probably should take him home. That voice. And she says, no, I'd hate to wake him up. You know, you're going to have to fight your way over there and be back early in the morning. Just leave him. So I said, okay, well, I'll leave him here. So I left him overnight, went back, took my daughter back the next morning, made my way back into work. Again, snowing all day long. And it's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because at the bank then you work till 6. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I get this call from the babysitter. And she says, you need to come now. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, Shannon is very sick. You need to come now. I mean now. Well, that can scare a mother. So I worked a good ways from the babysitter where mom lived. She was closer, so I called her. I said, Mom, the babysitter called, said Shannon's really sick. Will you please go over there and get him, bring him back to your house, and I'll meet you at your house. So she did. She goes over, picks him up. I drive to her house. And I get out of the car, or I'm at the house first, and I had walked into the foyer. She gets out of her car, comes in, and says, "Come with me, get in my car, and we're going to the hospital. You need to drive as fast as you can." And I'm looking at her like, "Mother, what is going on?" And she said, "Shannon has been beaten, and he is about to lose consciousness. I want you to drive. I may have to give him mouth-to-mouth in the back seat." So we get in my mother's car, and I am driving as fast as I can through snow, praying for a policeman who sees me speeding so that I can get to where I'm going faster, but no such luck on the time when you need them. So we drive to the hospital, and I have not even seen him. I'm attempting to look around a couple of times, and my mother's going, "No, just drive." I've not even seen my child at this point, so we get him out of the car. We run him into the ER, and my mother's got him like this, bundled up, and the ER nurse says, "What's the problem?" And my mother says, "This child's been beaten." Well, once those words come out of someone's mouth, what do you think everyone in the room is thinking? Who did it? So they grab the child, they look at him, they take him back, and with just in a moment, they say, "We cannot treat him here. He's going to have to be transported by ambulance to Vanderbilt Hospital. You will need to meet the ambulance driver there." I'm 21. I'm very young, probably very innocent, naive in the ways of the world at that time. And my mind is just racing. I cannot comprehend what is going on here. So we get to Vanderbilt Hospital. Well, by the time we get to the hospital, you'll never guess who was there to greet us. A policeman, yes, because once the word beaten has gotten out, there has to be a call that is made that authorities have to investigate. So we are greeted by a police officer at the hospital who immediately wants to talk to us to try to find out what happened. My mother had to do most of the talking because she picked the child up and had the last conversation with the babysitter. So she did most of the talking. They took Shannon into the ER. Still haven't seen him. Haven't had a chance to touch him, hold him, hug him, anything at this point. We talk with the police officer for probably an hour. A social worker comes. You talk with a social worker. Finally, and I don't remember this part, my mother actually reminded me of it, I didn't remember it initially, but they finally say, and it's probably 9 o'clock at night by now, "You can come and see him in the ER." So my mother and I go back, and here's my little baby laying on a table, and he has bruises on the front of him. He has a bite mark on an arm. He has bruises on his legs. And they have, tubes all in him at this point. And then they say, "Okay, you need to go back out now. We need to take him up to ICU. So I got to see him for maybe 3 minutes, and then I was escorted out. The police officer tells me, "I will be back tomorrow to talk with you again. I need to do some investigating," which is what police officers do. So they took Shannon up into the pediatric ICU. And we're getting close to midnight now. And they tell us that there's a waiting room that we can go and sit. And so I don't know how many of you have been in a large hospital waiting room. And this is not what I had to sit on, but it's close enough for illustration. They usually have a bench, flat bench. They're very sterile looking. The waiting room was circular with the nurse's station in the middle, and they had all these rooms around the edges. And then they had an exterior waiting room where you generally stayed most of the time, but they let me come into this interior waiting room, and they would let me know when I could have a few minutes to go in and see my child. So I'm sitting in this waiting room. It's midnight probably. It's dark. The lights are low. It's very quiet. And I have a moment just to sit there you know, I've grown up my whole life thinking that I was good, that I tried to do my best. You know, I didn't always listen. But God, what's going on here? God, you know, I can't do anything. I can't do anything. But you know what? Because I'm such a weak person, I can't even promise you that I'll do this or I'll do that if you will let my son live. He's in your hands. And I'll accept whatever you let happen. And I felt the presence of God. I felt an arm come around me and a presence next to me and a hug that said, I love you. It will be all right. So I sat there a while longer in my thoughts with God and relishing that warm embrace. And then finally they called me and they said, you can come see him now. So I got another few moments to go into a hospital room and see my son. And I reached out to touch him. And he pulled back. And my heart just broke. And the doctor said, that's normal. He's been through a very traumatic experience. Just give him a few days. So we made it through that night, and the next day the doctor says, he's going to make it. He's going to make it. He'll be fine. So he was in the hospital for 2 weeks. He basically had to learn how to walk again. He had to learn how to trust again. But it happened. It took time, but it happened. But that was the moment when God told me he loved me and it would be all right, that I knew it meant more than just my son. I knew that God had a plan for my life and I needed to make some changes. So I went after we got him out of the hospital. My mother kept him after that. No more babysitters. My mother was his babysitter. We made arrangements. And I went to the pastor of the church where my mother went because I had not been going to church. And he knew the story. I'd had a lot of people praying for me. And another thing I didn't tell you, while we're going through this whole ordeal of trying to process just what's happened to this child, I had policemen interrogate me. I had to take a lie detector test. I was considered a suspect until I could be ruled out as not a suspect. I had social workers have to come into my home, check my home. They had to talk to all of my neighbors. They had to talk to everyone that I worked with. If you've never been in a situation like that, where people have been heard, been allowed to hear something that makes them look at you in a different light, you don't want it. Because people will look at you with that doubt, wondering, unless they really know you. If they really know you, you're good. Fortunately, because I was somewhat of a good person, I did love my children. My neighbors were able to say, I've never seen her do anything to hurt her children. That's just not believable at all. My coworkers were able to say, no, this could not happen. She would not do that. And even the social worker, when she checked my home, said, no, there's no evidence that she would ever treat her children that way. So I was cleared as a suspect, and guess who that left? The babysitter. So again, that still small voice. Sometimes when your child is clinging to your leg, crying, don't let me go, mommy, try to find out why. that still small voice that was saying there's something not quite right here, that I was too naive to think anything other could have prevented. But I just didn't hear it. My ears, no matter what size, didn't catch it. My heart wasn't quite in tune with God to hear what he was telling me. But he had a plan for my life, and I am so grateful he did. You know, Arthur Maxwell, forgot to go back to the pastor. Sorry here, story. I went to my pastor, or the pastor, because I hadn't been going to church, and he knew what had happened, and I said, I want to make a change in my life. You know, I had promised God that I would not do anything. I wasn't going to promise something that I knew I wouldn't be able to keep. But when God did what he did and when he spoke to me the way he had, I knew there was nothing I could do but change at that time in my life. So I went to the pastor. I said, what do I need to do? Do I need to take Bible studies? Do I need to get rebaptized? What is it that I need to do so that I can make a change in my life? And he said, Sherry, you grew up in the Adventist church. You know the Bible. You've been baptized. If you want to make a change in your life, you live your life differently so that others can see it. You see that, Don Martin? You live your life differently so that others can see it. And that's what I did. I started living my life differently. I started changing who I associated with. I started changing the way I did things at home. I started going to church. I helped my mother in her kindergarten class. I started on a relationship with God. You know, there's 3 points to what I want to get across today. The first one was the listening. I hope you picked up on that. The first one was the listening to God. The second is making a change. When you hear God speak to you, you have to make a change, or it hasn't done any good at all. So you make a change, and I made that change. Arthur Maxwell sold his first religious books as a student canvasser at the age of 16. He was caught by the incoming tide while walking between two islands, and he attributed his escape to a direct act of providence, and thereafter lived convinced that God held a special destiny for him in his hand. And you all know who Arthur Maxwell was. He's the one that gave us the Bible stories. He sold more Bible stories than he ever imagined that he could sell. He listened to God at that moment when he needed him, and he trusted that God had a plan for his life, and he did. Now, just because you make a change and you start listening for God, is everything going to be A-okay? No, it's not. It's not at all. But the next step of my 3 points is search for God. Jeremiah says, when you search for me with all your heart, you will find me. Thus began my search. So the first important scripture that made a real impression on my life was Isaiah chapter 45, verse 22. I had remarried again. John and I met in 1980. He took me and my two children. He got a whole family package. And then we had a third child. And you're happy because you have this newly wedded bliss. But you're challenged because you have this immediate family package and you have to make it work. And so we were struggling. We were struggling to try to support kids, you know, to manage the household, to make everything work and come together. And I was getting to the point oftentimes where it was just like, Lord, help me. So I was so upset one day with how I was going to do something. I had read that morning Oswald Chambers, My Utmost for His Highest, and it said, look to me and be saved. I immediately got on my knees and looked to heaven and said, Lord, save me again. There's nothing I can do here. I need you. Isaiah 45:22, turn to me or look to me and be saved, all ye ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. It's like Janie said, if you will let go and let God, it's amazing what he can do for in our lives. But you know what? My husband can testify to this. I'm a pretty independent person. surprise, have a hard time letting go and letting God. But I wanted to continue searching for him. So my next search took me to when I really started getting involved with church. I was asked to be an elder, one of the first female elders in that church, which really surprised me. That was quite an honor that they felt that I could do that. But I was like, Lord, really? Me? No, you need to help me here. Well, then my husband was going to some classes for laymen for preaching to be able to assist the pastor. And one of his friends said, Sherry, you should try to do a sermon. We have to do a sermon. You should try to do one too. And I went, oh, that's kind of interesting. Maybe I should. So the verse that was really important to me at that time, and I did prepare the sermon, and this is what I prepared it on because I just love this verse. And it's Isaiah 42:16. I will lead the blind, and I have written in here, I will lead you, Sherry, by ways they have not known. Along unfamiliar paths I will guide them. I will turn the darkness into light before them and make the rough places smooth. These are the things I will do. I will not forsake them. God is going to take me through these rough patches that I don't understand. I just have to let go. I have to give it to him. So we keep plodding along in life. You know, it's just you do what you can and you keep struggling. Well, then I had another tragic thing happen, so to speak. The same child that we had this incident with when he was young started his rebelliousness at about 15. And I just didn't know what to do with him. So I sent him to my mom to live for a while, and that didn't really work. And so he decided he wanted to go live with his birth father. Like, okay, I don't think that's going to work either. So I send him to live with his birth father. Well, he got in with the wrong people. He stayed there for a number of years. He's actually 18 at this time, and he gets in with the wrong group of people. And he comes back home to live with us excitedly, which was kind of shocking. Wow, he wants to come back home and live. And okay, we knew he had a girlfriend down there, and he was leaving her behind. And then he started getting these phone calls. And we're like, what's going on? Well, he had gotten in with the wrong crowd. And unfortunately, Myra, he got in with some young men that decided to burglarize some homes. And he was encouraged by his mother and his father and a detective who tracked him down that he should turn himself in. So he turned himself in. This was quite an ordeal. It was his first time offense. Again, though, when you're a parent and you have no money, you have nothing you can do to help your child except place them in God's hands and a PA. You have to leave it up to God. And so as it turned out, he was given probation and had to make restitution. So he was put to work right away earning money. But that, again, was a miracle. But the interesting thing was he ended up in the same courthouse that I had been in 17 years earlier when he was a child going through a court hearing. And I thought, okay, God, how do I help this boy see that you have a plan for his life? Twice in the same courthouse, and twice you have rescued him. It's a miracle, Lord. Still working on that one. God knows the plans he has for us. Not giving up yet. But we keep going through life, and then I get more involved with church, and I've been encouraged to attend a seminar on inductive Bible study. And I'm thinking, no, I really don't want to go to that. It's a week-long seminar. Nah, I don't think that's something I'm interested in. And even my husband said, you should go. So I decided to go, and I went to this seminar, and I found another verse. And I realized that there was an issue in my life that I hadn't dealt with all of my life that had kind of been there, probably affecting a lot of the way I thought and so forth. And what it was abandonment. Didn't realize that I was dealing with issues of an abandonment as an adult. But without trying to embarrass my mother too much, there were some father issues there. Don't want to embarrass you, but had a few father issues. And by the time I married my husband, John, I really didn't like men at all. Really didn't like men at all. And he picked up on that, what, the first week? I think he said, "You really don't like men, do you?" And I went, no, not my favorite thing. No, just had too bad a time with men. They're all, no, just don't even want to go there. So we dated. Of course, he got through that. But I realized that I still carried a little bit of that with me. And when I went to this seminar, I found Ephesians 1, verse 4, and it says, "For he chose us in him before the creation of the world to be holy and blameless." And that was another verse that touched my heart in a way I'll never forget, that God chose me to be his child before the creation of the world, that he loves me. He's my father. He's my brother. He's my friend. And wow, what that did to me. So, to pull this all together for you, back to Jeremiah, he has a plan for our lives. And I love this verse so much, and it is a verse that I really think and study and meditate on. And I think I finally have figured out that what this plan is that God has for my life. And it's a culmination of all these verses, of searching and studying the Bible and wanting to know God and finding God. And his plan for my life is that I have a relationship with him so that he can restore me to what he originally intended when he chose me to be his child before the creation of the world. That's his plan for us. He wants to restore us to the children he intended us to be from the very beginning. But it starts with listening. Starts with listening to that small voice. You know, I brought a couple of props here with me today. I wanted to bring a few more things, but I just couldn't get it all. So I have more than big ears in here. Sometimes we have to wonder, what does it take for God to get our attention? You know, hey, are you listening to me? Now, I don't know about you guys, but when you see this come out, you ought to know somebody's trying to get your attention. Let's just test it. Heaven to Sherry, can you hear me? God will do whatever he can to get our attention. Sometimes he throws a brick over our head, but you know what? I'm here to tell you the most effective way is the still small voice. Phillips, Craig, and Dean have a song. It's called "It Wasn't in the Thunder That I Heard You Call My Name. It Wasn't in the Lightning That Made My Heart Change. It's a voice so still and tender, I'll never be the same." We have to listen for that still, small voice. I think I had a couple more pictures up here I wanted to just share with you. Oh, and here it is. Here is the song. "In life's complications and noisy frustrations, I lost the voice that meant the most to me. And then turn back the pages to innocent ages. I'll search until I hear you softly speak. It wasn't in the thunder where I heard you call my name. There were no lightning flashes that caused my heart to change. But a voice so small and tender like the soothing summer rain. It wasn't in the thunder where I heard you call my name." And then this next picture is the tall one in the back is Shannon. That was taken last year at 34 years old. So you can see that he grew up to be a big, scary looking guy. he doesn't like hair. It's curly and it tickles his ear, so he keeps his head shaved. So he has the goatee that can get down to here, which you can't see because of the shirt. But he's kind of scary. But the Lord has a plan for his life. And he and my daughter are my mission projects, still reaching out to them. My other son, Jonathan, fortunately is in the Word and talks to God and has an experience with him. Did I have one more up there? Yes. This is a song that I came across by Mac Powell, who I can't remember which group he was with. Does that sound familiar, Mac Powell? Wasn't Casting Crowns, can't remember. Tell me your story, show me your wounds, and I'll show you what love sees when love looks at you, should be you. Hand me the pieces broken and bruised, and I'll show you what love sees when love sees you. I see what I made in your mother's womb, and I see the day I fell in love with you. I see your tomorrows, nothing to chance. I see my father's fingerprints. I see your story. I see my name written on every beautiful page. You see the struggles. You see the shame. I see the reason I came. I came for your story. I came for your wounds to show you what love sees when love sees you, when I see you. That's why he came. I had so much more. I can see what it's like being up here. You have so much that you want to share. You know, I wanted to share that we have a story. We've been called to share our story. We're part of that cry of the third angel's message at the end of time. We have to tell others our story. We have to tell others of Jesus and his love. We have to tell others how he changes hearts. And we have to tell others his plan is to restore us and make us what he originally intended for us to be. Let's bow our heads in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this privilege to stand up this morning and share my story of how you totally changed my life, how you have drawn me into this relationship with you, and you won't let me go. And I hope that everyone here today will come to realize the same thing. There's always a still small voice speaking to us. There's a God that will never give up on us because you love us and you have a plan for us to be with you in heaven eternally. Bless us all. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. I'm going to ask Mr. Paul if he would come help me this morning with the children's story. And all you have to do is sit in this chair. Just need you to sit in this chair. That's it. Okay? Yeah. At one point, I may ask you to say something. Okay. I'm going to tell you a story about when I was a little girl and I was 7 years old. Most all of you look older than 7 years old, don't you? Eight. Yeah. Okay. So you were probably a lot smarter than I was at seven. But when I was 7 years old, I went to school by walking. I walked to school every day. And my mother would say, now when school is over, you make sure you walk straight home. You don't stop anywhere else. Well, one day, one of my friends said, you should ride the school bus with me. And I said, but I don't ride the school bus. Little voice is going, you better think about this. She goes, no, it'll be okay. You should ride the school bus with me. And I was thinking, the school bus doesn't know where I live. Oh, sure, it'll know where you live. It'll go right past your house. And I'm, I don't know if this is a good idea or not. Come on, ride with me. It'll be fun. We'll have a good time. So guess what I did? I rode the school bus. I got on the school bus with my friend, and the school bus is all full of kids. And it was kind of fun being on the school bus because I'd never been on a school bus before. So that was kind of fun. And we're riding along. The bus driver takes off. He starts driving. The bus school bus driver in the front starts driving. Yeah. And here we go. We're driving along, and then the bus driver stops so he can let some kids out. Let some kids out, and we're driving along again, and this is really nice. I'm looking at everything, and it's kind of fun. And he stops again, opens the door, lets some more kids out. Okay, then we drive again, driving along, and we're down to one other person besides me on the bus, and the bus driver stops, lets the last kid off the bus, closes the door, and then he turns around, and he looks at me, because that was the last kid on the drop-off. And he said, where do you live? And he said, where do you live? And I gave him my address, and he looked at me, and he said, we have a problem.
You have a problem.
So he's going to take me back to the school. So he cranks up the bus, off we go back to the school, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm in trouble now. He gets me to the school, stops the bus, opens the door, and lets me out. Takes me to the principal's office, and there I'm standing, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to be in so much trouble. My mom is going to be so mad. What's going to happen? So the principal says, thank you, Mr. Bus Driver. You can leave now. The principal calls my mother, and she just has me sit in this chair, and I'm waiting. And you know, the longer you wait, the more nervous you get about Mama coming and what's going to happen. So Mama comes, and she talks to the principal, and she says, I'm so sorry. And she gets me by the hand and calmly takes me out the door. But then when we got out the door, she did one of Uncle Don's tricks. She did this. And she gave me what for? About not listening to her and coming straight home from school like I'm supposed to, which is walking home. Now, you know what? I had this little voice telling me I probably shouldn't do that. That wasn't a good idea. But I wasn't listening very well. So I'm wondering. I want to try a little experiment with you guys here this morning. If I had some bigger ears, do you think I would have been able to listen better? I want you to open these up and put on some bigger ears here, and we're going to test it. I want you to tell me if you can listen better if you got some bigger ears, okay? That might be what I needed. Yeah, you can keep them. Let's put on those big ears. You just hook it onto your ear, those big ears. Yeah. Now can you hear? Whoops, we got flying ears up here. Okay, everybody got their big ears on? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me better with your big ears? Can you hear? You can't get them hooked on? Maybe Mama and Daddy can get you hooked on. The point is, do you think you can listen any better if you have big ears? No, because you know what? Sometimes listening comes from the mind and the heart. Remember, there was a little boy in the Bible that God called him in the night. Do you remember what his name was? His name was Samuel, and God called him in the night. And he got up and he ran to the priest and he said, did you call me? And the priest said, no. And this happened 3 times, and finally the priest said, it must be God talking to you. Listen to him. Go back and lay down. And when God calls your name, you listen to him. And he didn't have to have bigger ears the next time to hear God when he talked to him. So remember, boys and girls, it doesn't matter how big or how little your ears are to help you listen. It's using your mind and your heart and listening to people, and more importantly, to God, that still small voice when he's talking to us. Okay?